From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Linda Greenhouse about the just-finished term of the Supreme Court. Greenhouse is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times. She says the court headed by Chief Justice John Roberts showed its conservative cast in a series of decisions, ranging from school integration and campaign finance to antitrust law. And some harsh words were exchanged in opinions among the justices. Later, we'll hear about the songwriting career of Doc Pomus. Rock historian Ed Ward tells us about the man who wrote hits for Elvis Presley and Ray Charles. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. The first full term of the Supreme Court led by Chief Justice John Roberts ended last week, and its more conservative cast was reflected in a series of 5-4 decisions on a broad range of legal issues, from school desegregation to antitrust law. Our guest today is Linda Greenhouse, who's covered the court for the New York Times for most of the last 3 decades. Among her many journalistic awards is the 1998 Pulitzer Prize for beat reporting. Well, Linda Greenhouse, welcome back to Fresh Air. Most of us expected this to be a more conservative Supreme Court. Is it about what we expected?
Yes, I think, as I wrote in the paper on Sunday, it's the court that conservatives had longed for and that liberals feared. So it was dreams come true and fears realized. I think there were a couple of surprises in, I would say, not so much outcomes, not bottom line outcomes, but in the music of these decisions, the tonality of the court. I think the majority hung together more than one might have expected. Justice Kennedy was with the more solidly, perhaps conservative 4 justices in almost all the important cases. I think that was maybe a bit of a surprise. And the tone, the aggressiveness of some of the opinions, the reaching out to invite subsequent challenges and the suggestions that a number of precedents are on very weak legs right now, that was a bit of a surprise.
All right, well, let's go over some of the more important decisions that the court has issued and that you've written about. One of the most high-profile ones, of course, came in the area of school desegregation, striking down plans by Seattle and Louisville. What were these school districts doing that the court found unconstitutional?
What the opinion by Chief Justice Roberts found unconstitutional, and it's significant that Justice Kennedy, who joined the majority for the result but didn't subscribe to the Chief Justice's analysis, what the plurality found unconstitutional was the counting by race in both of these school districts. They both sought to keep the schools balanced roughly in proportion to the racial makeup of the school districts. And in order to do that, when a student applied to enter a school or transfer to a different school, that request would be accepted or denied based on whether it would or would not unbalance the schools. And the court found that unconstitutional.
So the flaw was taking in race into account on decisions about individual students?
On an individual basis, that's right, taking account of individuals' race.
And it's interesting that both sides in this case, the minority and the majority, paid homage to Brown versus Board of Education.
Well, more than homage, they each claimed that their analysis was, in effect, compelled by the equal protection analysis of Brown against Board of Education, which, of course, is a very fascinating situation. For the Chief Justice, the lesson of Brown was that the Constitution is colorblind, and it should have been colorblind in the era of de jure segregation, and that was the holding of Brown in 1954, and it should be equally colorblind today when these school districts are engaged in what used to be called benign rather than invidious discrimination. But to take the Chief Justice at his word, there is no such distinction. There's no such thing as, quote, benign discrimination. Discrimination is discrimination. And he said in the final line of his opinion, if you want to stop racial discrimination, you have to stop discriminating by race. Now, the dissent, of course, claimed very passionately that it was carrying forward the legacy of Brown, which was equal opportunity, and that Brown tells us that school districts have to be able to continue affirmative efforts. This is not an affirmative action case, but affirmative efforts to maintain integration or prevent resegregation that, as we know, because of residential housing patterns and economic patterns, still exists on a very widespread basis more than 50 years after Brown.
Now, you noted that Justice Kennedy did side with the conservative majority in this case, but issued a different opinion, which might hold out hope for a different approach than conservatives might expect. What is Kennedy's view of this?
Kennedy's view, as a matter of equal protection doctrine, and this gets a little bit down into the weeds, but it's important to understand where he's coming from. He said there is a compelling state interest in eliminating racial isolation. That's really important because the Roberts opinion says there is no such compelling state interest. And under equal protection doctrine, if there's not a compelling state interest, the government cannot do anything. Kennedy said, no, our society has a real stake in eliminating racial isolation. So they come from very different starting points. And Kennedy's starting point is the same as the starting point of the four dissenters of the Breyer dissent. Where Kennedy differs from the dissenters is in the next step of 14th Amendment analysis. Once you've got a compelling state interest, you've got to have a remedy for the problem that is narrowly tailored. That's the term of art, narrowly tailored to serve that interest. And Kennedy said these plans are basically too blunt an instrument. It's too crude a technique to count the students by race, to identify the students by race. And so that's where he departs. So that leaves him with a range of options that he offers in his opinion, such measures as drawing attendance zones with the consciousness of race. If a school district is carving up the attendance zones, it can do that with the goal of producing an integrated student body school by school, or where to place a school, or what kind of magnet program to offer, or recruiting faculty, recruiting students. He offers these explicitly as measures that would pass his test of being sufficiently narrowly tailored. The dissent, Justice Breyer's dissent, takes him on point by point on this and says, these have been tried, these have failed, these are not sufficient. The measures under consideration here, the Seattle plan, the Louisville plan, are in fact very modest voluntary integration plans, and they meet our test of being narrowly tailored. So that's where the difference lies.
So school districts can still pursue racial integration, but they must use different means to do it other than racial decisions regarding individual students. They can still craft boundaries. They can still use magnet schools, it appears.
Yes. Now, you know, the dissent or the civil rights community would say, well, that's very nice as an abstract matter. But in point of fact, these are deeply political and expensive types of programs. You know, anybody that's followed issues involving public schools, especially in city, suburban districts like Louisville, which is a metropolitan school district that includes the city and the suburbs, you know, where you put a new school or where you draw attendance zones, these are deeply political, you know, community issues. So it's not as if school boards can kind of snap their fingers and accomplish this, but it certainly does mean something other than the sort of no way, no how bottom line of the Roberts opinion.
You wrote that Justice Stephen Breyer spoke with rare emotion from the bench in this case. What did he say?
Well, he was on. He spoke for more than 20 minutes, and he produced a 77-page dissenting opinion, speaking for himself and the other four dissenters, Justice Stevens, Justice Souter, and Justice Ginsburg. He summarized his opinion from the bench. He read chunks of it, but the kind of striking thing that he said on the bench that actually was not in his printed opinion, he said, this may not be quite an exact quote, but it's very rare in the law that so few have changed so much so quickly. And this was interpreted as a reflection not only on this particular decision, but coming on the last day of the term, which had found him and the other three dissenters in dissent many, many times. I think it was meant to be and was certainly received as a reflection on the entire term.
You also note some very pointed words that Justice Clarence Thomas had in one of his opinions addressing some of these issues, right?
Yes, Justice Thomas wrote an opinion concurring with the Roberts opinion, a very personal statement. One thing he said that was a little bit breathtaking is something to the effect of history has taught us that elites and their racial theories, as he put it, don't do any good. And then he had a footnote saying Justice Breyer is a person of goodwill, but his goodwill will last as long as his tenure on the court. Whoa, that's a quite strange thing for one justice to say about another.
What was Justice Thomas saying here?
I think what he was saying is that it was a very personal statement. And what he was saying is the elites, that's his word, have been cobbling up these programs for the ostensible benefit of Black and other minority children for many years. And that's a form of discrimination that, in Justice Thomas's mind, does not actually work to the benefit of these children. And what he was saying to Justice Breyer is, you're telling me that these programs are benign and that they reflect the goodwill of these elites, but that's your view. And that goodwill, as you express it, is going to last as long as you're on the court and no longer. So what that actually was about, only Justice Thomas knows, but it was a very startling kind of discourse.
Our guest is Linda Greenhouse. She covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining me, my guest is Linda Greenhouse. She covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Another important ruling by this court came in the area of campaign finance law, the McCain-Feingold law, which the court upheld in a case in 2003. What did the justices decide in this case?
The decision in the campaign finance law was addressed to a part of the McCain-Feingold law that actually, when the court had looked at McCain-Feingold for the first time 4 years ago, had gotten pretty short shrift. This was the provision that said that corporations and unions cannot pay for advertising out of their treasuries that names a candidate for federal office within 30 days before a primary, 60 days before the general election. The only kind of ads they can run are genuine issue ads, not electioneering. So the question here was, how does that kind of general language, general prescription, apply to a set of ads that a small organization called the Wisconsin Right to Life Committee tried to run in the summer of 2004 when Senator Russ Feingold was running for re-election in Wisconsin. This was a test case because the lawyer for the Wisconsin Right to Life Committee is a very creative, energetic man named James Bopp, who has kind of cobbled up test cases, testing limitations on campaign election speech for many years. So he devised these ads for this group to run and brought them forward, saying, if I don't have a First Amendment core political right to broadcast these ads, then there's not too much left of the First Amendment. And he got five justices to agree with him. They didn't overturn the provision in McCain-Feingold, but what they did was kind of turn the tables. They said, and again, in John Roberts' opinion, they said, not only does the organization that wishes to speak, the corporation or the union that wishes to speak, not have to prove that it's entitled to speak, but the burden is on the government, and the government has to show that there's no substantial reason that anybody would interpret the ad as something other than a strict electioneering ad. And this opens a, substantial, substantial is a big word, and burden shifting to the government is a big shift. This really opens the door to corporate-sponsored and union-sponsored campaign advertising in the opposite way from what the sponsors of the McCain-Feingold law had.
So what we're talking about here are these so-called issue ads in which you say Senator so-and-so appears to be a horse thief, call his office and tell him. So you're not telling people how to vote, but you're clearly distributing a negative message, or in some cases a positive message, about a particular candidate. The court says, now, that's fine as long as you don't explicitly advocate a vote?
Yeah, they don't precisely say that, but the government has to show that an ad that names a candidate but doesn't explicitly say vote for or vote against is something other than a genuine issue ad. It's where to draw the line between what are known as genuine issue ads and what are known as sham issue ads. And the McCain-Feingold sponsors had tried to craft this in a way that would rule out the sham issue ads. It's a hard line to draw when you have very sophisticated people crafting language that is right up to the line. And what the court decision did is really move the line so that there's to enable, I think, a good deal more of these ads right up to the eve of the election.
Right. So is anything left now of the restrictions on unlimited money, in which people can make huge contributions, not disclose donors, not abide by contribution limits? Is there anything left to the law?
Well, on paper, there certainly is, because this was one section of McCain-Feingold, but the first section, which was not directly at issue in this case, were the limitations on soft money, that is the unregulated money that under McCain-Feingold political parties can no longer accept from corporations and unions. So as a matter of formality, the soft money limits are still there. As a matter of reality on the ground, I mean, we'll see. We're obviously coming into the hot and heavy election season, but as a matter of reality, I think it's reasonable to expect that the corporate soft money will simply flow into these advertising campaigns, which are now enabled by what the court specifically held in this case. So there's kind of a seamless web that connects the two major provisions of McCain-Feingold. And if you kind of undermine one, I think inevitably you undermine the other.
There was also a decision involving separation of church and state. This involved the taxpayers' right to challenge government expenditures that they believe may violate the church-state separation of the Constitution. Briefly, what was this about, and what's the significance of this decision?
This was a lawsuit challenging the Bush administration's expenditure of funds, federal money, in support of its faith-based initiative. The basic principle in the law is that taxpayers, simply by virtue of being taxpayers, who don't like some government policy, don't have the right to go into court to challenge it. They don't have standing as a legal matter. But some decades ago, the court carved out an exception to that general principle and said that when it comes to the Establishment Clause, the separation of church and state, there's a special rule. And if the government is spending money in a way that somebody alleges breaches the barrier between church and state, taxpayers who don't like that can come into court and challenge it. Now, this precedent has stood for 40 years or so, but it's taken quite a few hits, and it took a big hit in this case. The majority did not directly overturn it, but they limited it. They said, okay, the precedent stands for only enabling taxpayers to challenge direct congressional enactments. If Congress passed a law saying the White House shall have a faith-based initiative program, that would still be open to challenge under this opinion. But because here President Bush had set up the Office of Faith-Based Initiatives and was carrying out those initiatives through a series of executive orders and through the expenditure not of targeted congressional money, but just general executive branch appropriations, the court said the old precedent doesn't apply and there's no standing, and this suit is thrown out. We're not reaching the merits of it.
So it gives the executive branch greater latitude to enact programs which may embrace faith-based organizations, it seems.
Without being open to challenge in court.
Right.
And what both the dissenters said and Justice Scalia, in an opinion and concurring in the judgment, said, that doesn't make any sense. You know, money is fungible. These are congressional appropriations. The dissenters said standing should apply to both. Justice Scalia said it should be all or nothing, and what he wanted to do was simply overturn the old precedent and cut off standing to sue, to challenge any of these programs, no matter what their origin was. So, you know, maybe both of those are a little bit logically more coherent than what the court came up with.
Linda Greenhouse covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Classics edition of The Federalist, papers by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay, in stores and online at bn.com. And from TIAA Cref, helping those who serve others plan for and live in retirement, online at TIAACREF.org. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose, at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I told her when it comes to talking.
Coming up, we continue our interview with Linda Greenhouse. She began covering the Supreme Court in 1978, and she won the Pulitzer Prize for her reporting in the New York Times. Also, Lonely Avenue and Save the Last Dance for Me. Rock historian Ed Ward profiles songwriter Don Pomus.
Well, I talked to her off the floor when she said,
go, Jimmy, go.
I told her when it comes to dancing, I'm the best young dancer in the land. Well, she looked at me with a twinkle in her eye, and then she took my hand and she said,
this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Last Thursday marked the end of the first Supreme Court session chaired by Chief Justice John Roberts. We're speaking with Linda Greenhouse, who covers the court for the New York Times. She wrote Sunday that its decisions show the Roberts Court is the Supreme Court that conservatives had long yearned for and liberals had feared. On the abortion issue, the court upheld the federal ban on the procedure that opponents call partial birth abortion, and this was after, I guess, a few years back, the court ruled the other way on a state ban of the procedure. What does this ruling tell us to expect from this court on the abortion issue as years proceed?
What the ruling tells us is that with Justice Alito substituted for Justice O'Connor, this is a court that's now narrowly but quite decidedly more receptive to government limitations on access to abortion. So the polarity of the court changed on this, and also the language of the court changed. This was an opinion by Justice Kennedy, who had been a dissenter 7 years ago, the last time the court looked at one of these laws. He now writes for the majority in language that really hasn't been heard from the court before in its decades of consideration of abortion laws. What he was basically saying is this ban on this procedure is actually good for women because women don't necessarily know what they're doing, he said. And so the fact that they're not going to be able to make this particular choice is actually a favor to them.
What's the likelihood of a reversal of Roe versus Wade?
Well, I don't think this really tells us much about that. There are people who say that if the court keeps whittling away in this way, there may not be much left to Roe against Wade. You know, time will tell about that. But I think it's reaching a little bit to jump from this to saying, okay, there's now 5-0 to overturn Roe, because Justice Kennedy is still on record. In 1992, he was part of the majority that voted to reaffirm Roe against Wade. And he's obviously never liked this particular procedure. He was a dissenter in 2000, but I think it's overreading his opinion to say that he's now a vote to overturn Roe.
You know, it's often noted that the court tends to move incrementally because of its respect for precedent. Stare decisis, that intimidating Latin word, which means you've got to respect where previous justices have ruled in the past. To what extent would you say this court is more likely than past courts to reverse precedent and strike out in more radical legal directions?
That's kind of a work in progress. We certainly saw some tension in the court this term. We have Justice Scalia out there really needling, very overtly, somewhat surprisingly, the Chief Justice, saying, look what you're doing. This doesn't quite make sense. You're trying to shade this precedent. You're overturning it functionally without acknowledging it. Why don't we just overturn it and be very clear about it? This came up in several cases. The Chief Justice was holding back against that. So there's obviously a dynamic in play on the court today that is going to continue working its way out. A lot of energy there, a lot of feeling, I think, on that side of the court that, you know, our moment has come and we ought to push it as far and fast as we want to, as we can. On the other hand, within that group, there's also a feeling that, you know, the court has limited political capital and incremental is more palatable, is more saleable, is more comfortable. And we're working on a long timeline and we've got some time here. So that's one thing that's going to be really interesting going forward. This was just the end of the second year of the Roberts Court. I think we'll have many decades of the Roberts Court, and that's really something to watch.
You said justices think of the court as having political capital. That sort of goes against the grain of our notion of this esteemed body.
Well, no, I don't want to be misunderstood. I don't mean they think of themselves as politicians, but, you know, as we know from past decisions, you know, the court doesn't have an army to summon. The court makes decisions and really relies on long-term public support for them to be accepted. I mean, that's part of the lesson of Brown against Board of Education. So I think history tells us that when the court gets far out in front of what the public is willing to support, it's weakened as an institution, and there's a political reaction against that. Many people think that's what happened during the Warren Court years, that the Warren Court pro-defendant decisions on criminal procedure principally set up a political dynamic that enabled Richard Nixon in 1968 to run in part against the court very effectively, and that ushered in this very long period of response and reaction that we see playing out now almost 40 years later. I mean, this is a very, you know, profound and interesting set of issues that are hard to, you know, I don't want to be glib about it. There's a great deal of scholarship on this.
You've written about a particularly harsh tone that Justice Scalia has taken in some of his opinions directed at the Chief Justice Roberts. Can you think of an example and maybe give us a sense of the significance of these exchanges?
Well, as we were saying before, Justice Scalia has been prodding and pushing Chief Justice Roberts to overtly be willing to tackle precedent and overturn precedent that both of them don't like, and the Chief Justice has hung back on that. So within recent days, we've seen Justice Scalia really turning up the heat, and in one concurring opinion, he said to the Chief Justice, this faux judicial restraint is judicial obfuscation. What he's saying is, you've really, this was in the campaign finance case, you've functionally overturned this part of McCain-Feingold without having the guts to say so openly, and it would be a lot better for the whole system if we just labeled and came out front with what we're doing. So that's what he meant by this faux judicial restraint. He's kind of needling him because Chief Justice Roberts has gone around giving speeches about the utility, the desirability of what he calls judicial restraint. So, you know, Justice Scalia is an equal opportunity offender. He's willing to, you know, insult anybody and has done that pretty consistently over the years. And it was just interesting that the new Chief Justice is not exempt from this.
My guest is Linda Greenhouse. She covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Our guest is Linda Greenhouse, who covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. We're talking about the just completed term of the court, the first term chaired by Chief Justice John Roberts. You know, most people who are talking about these court decisions don't actually read the opinions, much less the arguments that led to them. We get that information from you and others who write about it. And being where you are at the vortex, I'm sure, of a storm of spin where everybody faxes and emails you their view of what the court has done, and you've got to make sense of it and give us all a rational and balanced view. And I wonder, as you look at all the commentary about what this more conservative court has achieved in the last term, is there anything that you feel that the commentators have misread, exaggerated, gotten wrong?
Oh, that's an interesting question. No, people try to find the good and the bad in court decisions that serves their interest. And I think in a number of these decisions, there's enough ambiguity to make intellectually respectable arguments on both sides. I mean, for instance, the school integration case. It was interesting as the day went on to see the civil rights community find more and more comfort in Justice Kennedy's separate opinion, saying, see, we still have something left here. Whereas the other side, the plaintiffs who had brought this case and challenged the plans, were saying, look, we got the colorblind constitution that we've always thought was the correct way to interpret the 14th Amendment. You know, I wouldn't say either one is completely right or completely wrong, but it was just interesting to watch the divergence get wider as the day went on and people had a chance to read and consult with each other and decide how they wanted to pitch this to the public.
As the court term ended, the court agreed to hear a case involving detainees held at Guantanamo Base. And this, I gather, was something they had declined to hear in April, but decided that they will hear these detainees petition to seek redress in the federal courts. What's at stake here? Was this a surprise?
This was a huge surprise. In fact, it apparently has not been since the 1940s that the court did what it did on Friday, which was grant a petition for rehearing, that is, take a case that they had formally denied, turned down just a few months ago, reconsidered without any intervening lower court decision, and said, you know, on reconsideration, we're going to hear this case. What this case is the fundamental challenge by the Guantanamo detainees, two large groups of them, to the legislation that stripped the federal courts of jurisdiction to hear any cases from the Guantanamo detainees. So the question is, do these individuals have a right to get their cases into federal court? It's the third time that this issue, in one guise or another, has come to the Supreme Court. In both of the last two decisions, 2004 and then just a year ago, the court rebuffed the administration and said these people do have some rights. The court didn't define substantively what the rights were, but they have the ability to assert some rights. So this is the playing out of something that's been building up for a long time, and it just is fascinating that the court at the very end of its term said, well, it's now up to us again, and we're going to hear this.
And how do you read this? Why do you think they decided to take it?
Well, I wish I knew. there's a theory. When the court turned it down in April, there were three justices, Justice Breyer, Justice Souter, and Justice Ginsburg, who wrote a dissenting statement and said, we think this is very important. We think we should take this. We dissent. There were two other justices, Justice Stevens and Justice Kennedy, who issued what they called a statement respecting the denial, saying, we agree it's important, but we think these detainees should, quote, exhaust their available remedies. That means they should go through the appeals process that was set up by the two federal laws that issue, the Detainee Treatment Act and the Military Commissions Act, and then at the end of the day, we'll be open to hearing them. My theory as to what happened, this is very complicated, so bear with me for a couple of seconds, but it's really interesting. There are events moving on parallel tracks, and in the Federal Appeals Court for the District of Columbia Circuit, right now, that court has under submission, awaiting decision, a case challenging the adequacy of those very same appeal procedures. In arguing that case, which was argued in May, the federal government had to come in and define exactly what, in its view, those procedures are. And this was all on the public record, and they filed briefs, and they had argument and so on, and the appeals court in the argument seemed a little bit skeptical that these were sufficient. And I think the justices are well aware of this because the detainees' lawyers filed extra papers with the Supreme Court making sure the justices knew about this. And these extra papers included a statement from a military officer who had sat on one of these tribunals and had found the procedures very inadequate. So the court, although nothing formally had happened yet, the justices, or at least these five justices, had a pretty good idea of what game was afoot, and I think thought, you know, this is going to come to us sooner or later. We're going to have to take it. We might as well just take it now. There's something there that really needs our review.
Your piece in Sunday's New York Times on this court's ruling had a very interesting graphic that accompanied it, which was a depiction which showed the five justices, pictures of all nine justices, showing the five who ruled in the majority on a given case in full color, and then the foreign minority in a faded kind of color. What was fascinating about it was that you could see that Justice Kennedy was the swing vote every time. Is he now the target of every attorney arguing a case before the Supreme Court? The goal is to get Justice Kennedy?
Well, yes, and that's been the case. When Justice O'Connor was also on the court, the goal was to pitch to the two of them. And now it's just Justice Kennedy. So, yes, he voted with the majority in all 24 of the 24 5-4 decisions. So that tells us nobody's going to win a 5-4 case without him. So certainly the lawyers pitched their arguments to him. There were some issues that he's not, gettable on. He's a person of firm views. He's been on the court for a long time. So it's really a very interesting situation.
Well, Linda Greenhouse, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Linda Greenhouse covers the Supreme Court for the New York Times. Coming up, Ed Ward remembers Doc Pomus, who wrote hits for Elvis Presley and Ray Charles. This is Fresh Air. These days, songwriters are usually also performers and often stars. Back in the 1950s, though, songwriting was mostly a job that involved working in an office and selling what you produced. Doc Pomus was one of the best, both at writing and selling, to clients as diverse as Elvis Presley and Ray Charles. Rock historian Ed Ward says a new collection captures his long career.
Doc Pomus was born Jerome Solon Felder in Brooklyn in 1925, and at six, he contracted polio. While he recuperated at home, he fell in love with music and pursued it throughout high school. At the age of 16, he heard a Big Joe Turner record, and his life was transformed. He began hanging out in Greenwich Village while attending college in Brooklyn, and one night a band leader invited him up to sing. Naturally, he chose a Big Joe Turner song, and the crowd loved him. Soon, he was singing in clubs all over New York using the name Doc Pomus, which he invented to avoid embarrassing his family, and using that name on the songs he'd started writing. Jazz critic Leonard Feather, who was also a songwriter, caught him one night and invited him to record a couple of songs on the Apollo label. Feather's songs, of course. Soon, though, Doc was recording his own stuff, although he never really had a hit. In 1955, his cousin introduced him to her latest boyfriend, a young man named Mort Schumann, who was fascinated by this short, portly white guy with leg braces who sang at black clubs. Doc encouraged the kid to start writing himself, and soon a partnership was formed. Doc, whose performing career was going nowhere, was always looking for writing partners, especially after his idol, Big Joe, recorded a song he'd written with Reginald Ashby.
She wears a low overshoes, dungaree, red jacket, short. If you please, mom, boogie woogie, boogie woogie, boogie woogie country girl. Well, I mean, what I mean, mom, boogie woogie country girl. Now you dig that music with a beat rockin' rollin'. Meet my boogie woogie, boogie woogie, boogie woogie country girl. Well, I mean, what I mean, my boogie woogie country girl. On Saturday night,
the song did well, and Atlantic Records, which had released it, encouraged Doc to do more. By himself, he wrote a more personal song than he'd ever done and submitted it to Ray Charles, who recorded it immediately.
Now my room has got two windows, but the sunshine never comes through. You know it's always dark and dreary since I broke off, baby, with you. I live on a lonely avenue. My little girl wouldn't say I do. But I feel so sad and blue, and it's all because of you. I live on
Lonely Avenue.
Oh,
Lonely,
yes, sir.
Avenue.
Now you know my covers. It feels
suddenly, Doc was hot. Before long, Doc refashioned a song Elvis had turned down called I'm a Man and turned it into Fabian's debut, Turn Me Loose, which I'll spare you. Somehow, this 25-year-old former blues shouter could tap into teenage angst, and his writing partner, Mort Schumann, could come up with melodies that were just right. A bunch of kids from Belmont Avenue in the Bronx were the next to benefit from their talents.
Ooh, wow. Ooh, wow. Each time we have a quarrel, it almost breaks my heart, 'cause I'm so afraid that we will have to part. Why must I be a teenager in love? One day
when he did write something personal, Doc made it universal. He was married by now, and Wilma, his wife, loved to dance, which, because of his legs, Doc couldn't do very well. Still, on weekends, he'd take her to a dance hall and sit while she danced with others, and then, when the band leader called the last dance, get up and stumble around the floor with her. He turned this experience into one of his most memorable songs, written for the Drifters.
You can dance every dance with the guy who gives you the eye to let him hold you tight. You can smile every smile for the man who held your hand neath the pale moonlight. But don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, save the last dance for me. Oh, I know,
oh, I know
that the music's
yes,
fine like sparkling
oh,
wine. Go and have your
yes,
fun.
Oh, I know.
Laugh and sing.
Yes, I know.
But while we're apart,
oh,
don't give your
yes,
heart to anyone.
Oh,
but
yes,
don't forget who's taking you home and in whose arms you're gonna be. So darling, say the last dance for me. Baby, don't you know I love you so.
Before this record came out, Doc and Mort visited England, where they were celebrities based on several early British rockers' versions of their U.S. hits. And while they were there, they ran into Lamar Fike, one of Elvis's Memphis Mafia, who'd been visiting Elvis in the army in Germany. They quickly demoed up a couple of songs and gave them to Fike, and soon they were contributing material to Elvis himself.
one girl, I've got a heart for two. There's just so much love in that one heart's supposed to do. So I go around with my heart dragging on the ground, dogging me around. I'm the sorriest sight in town. I got double trouble, I got double trouble, I got double trouble. Twice as much as anybody else, oh yeah.
I didn't say it was good material, but it was what Elvis and the Colonel liked. By the time Double Trouble came out in 1967, Doc and Mort were on different tracks. Mort had married a glamorous Israeli singer and was running around Europe with her. Doc had had a fall and now had to use a wheelchair. Double Trouble was their last collaboration, and Mort moved to Europe to promote his latest discovery, the Belgian songwriter Jacques Brel. Doc had become divorced. He ran a poker school out of his apartment and stopped writing songs for almost 10 years until Mac Rebenek, Dr. John, coaxed him out of retirement. He also began teaching songwriting to a new generation, including Willie DeVille. Doc Pomus died of lung cancer in 1991, just as his star was rising again. He was one of the last of the old-time pop songwriters and fortunately lived just long enough to see himself appreciated for it.
Ed Ward lives in Berlin. You can hear the songs Ed played on the CD The Pomus and Schumann Story, Double Trouble, 1956 to 1967.
This magic moment, so different and so new, was like any other.
Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillug, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Menhivar. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Sweeter than wine, softer than the summer night. Everything I want I have whenever I hold you tight.
Support for NPR comes from the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. From the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable, on the web at grdodge.org. And from the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Life at 45 RPM, we talk with Frankie Valli. There's a new box set of his recordings. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
They don't cry.